This is How Success Happens, where we talk to polar explorers, war correspondents, founders, ultramarathoners, authors, artists, and a range of other unique personalities to help you understand the capabilities behind how success happens.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
When I'm training for an ultramarathon, anywhere from 100 to 120 miles a week would be in my training cycle. Lots of miles.
You sold something like 250,000 books.
I'm the managing editor at entrepreneur.com and your host, Linda Lacina. Today, we talk to Caroline Webb. She's an Oxford and Cambridge trained economist who worked for 12 years at McKinsey, helping leaders better run top companies. She's since become an entrepreneur, founding SevenShift, a company that helps leaders use behavioral science to boost their effectiveness and productivity. She packed many of the strategies she's researched and learned into her book, How to Have a Good Day, a sort of manual for your head, packed with science-based shortcuts that work across cultures, ages, and backgrounds. She'll chat with us about how better understanding our brains can help us manage our reactions and our days. She'll also talk about her journey from entrepreneur to entrepreneur and how she puts the shortcuts she's learned into practice every day. But first, a word from our sponsor. We'll start with a bit of trivia. In 1677, as I'm sure you all know, England passed something called the Statute of Frauds, which insisted that legal contracts must be in writing and signed. Well, that system then moved over to colonial America, and fast forward 3 centuries, we're all somehow doing the same thing on repeat. But at least there's now a better way to do it. Hallelujah. It's called Sign Easy. It's a simple, secure system for your business to digitally sign and distribute documents. You can scan and sign a document, have the system pass that document around to multiple people in whatever sequence you want, track the progress of that document, and even send reminders to the stragglers, the people who still need to put pen to paper, finger to screen. Can you imagine trying to explain this to the Parliament of 1677? Anyway, we today just call it the normal course of business. To get started for free, go to getsigneasy.com/podcast. Hi, Caroline. How are you?
Oh, it's great to be here, Linda.
We are excited to have you. So why don't you give everybody the movie trailer version of your background? Catch us up.
Well, I'd be played by Keira Knightley, obviously, with my accent.
Yes.
So I was always interested in science. That was my first career ambition was to be an astrophysicist. But then when I was 16, I took a class in economics and realized that my real passion was the science of human behavior. And that was my first career. I worked as an economist in public service through the 90s. And then I spent 12 years at McKinsey doing leadership development and cultural change work, everything that was centered on the human being when we're thinking about how to perform better, how a company might outperform. And I loved it. It was fantastic. And then I was ready for a new challenge. And when I was thinking about what the next adventure would be, there was a real itch to write more, and not just to write articles, but perhaps to kind of write a life's work kind of book. And that was how to Have a Good Day came about. And now I have a lovely portfolio life with still a lot of coaching and consulting and workshopping, but also a lot of speaking and writing. And it's a pretty great life.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. In reading your book, I was really interested on how rooted in the primal so much of our reactions are. Can you talk a little bit about that, the connection to our brain and some of these bases that we may not even be aware of?
There's been such fantastic research in the behavioral sciences, by which I mean the neuroscientists, the psychologists, and the economists are interested in explaining human behavior, why we think, feel, and behave the way we do. And, you know, a lot of that research over the last 30 years has a lot to tell us about how we can be at our best more often, but not a lot of it has really made its leap into, you know, how we run meetings and how we think about our to-do lists. And that's what I became very interested in, was that translation. And you know, sometimes you think, well, gosh, you know, I quite enjoy reading an article which has a brain illustrating it. But, you know, do I really have to kind of get into deep neuroscience to actually understand how to be at my best more often? And the truth is, no, there are a couple of really big ideas that have come out of the combination of those disciplines that really help us to thrive more often. And you know, one of them is about the fact that the conscious part of our brain gets overloaded very easily. And we kind of all know that when we've just tried to read through 100 emails. But there's a real phenomenon there that we can pay attention to understand how to not overload our brains too much so that we don't go on autopilot when we don't want to. And then there's something about how we respond under stress and better understanding how our brains respond when we perceive any kind of threat in the environment. And if we better understand that, then we can manage the ups and downs of life as they come at us. And the combination of those two big ideas really is the core of what you need to know.
Do you think that most people are aware of that sort of connection between the brain and some of what's sort of going on in the background and just sort of how effective they are day to day?
Well, no, I think it's surprising, actually, because, I mean, there are lots and lots of articles in newspapers and magazines these days which do talk about this quirky study and this quirky response that our brains have to, eating Oreos or whatever. And I think that, people have become interested, but they don't see the direct connection. And that's, if you're an entrepreneur, you want to make sure that the product or the service that you're creating has a market, has a need, that you're not just shooting this sort of brilliant idea into the ether. And there's a market for it, there's a demand. And definitely I had clients say to me, this translation of the science into the super practical, the way that I might sort of handle a difficult conversation, where is that written down? And so that was why I thought, actually, there could be a need for a nice, clear explanation of how to make that translation. So, yeah, I mean, I think the fact that there wasn't as much connection as I might like led me to see that there was an opportunity to help to fill that and to make that connection clearer.
No, for sure, for sure. You just mentioned a sort of entrepreneurs trying to solve these problems and push these things forward. And you were an entrepreneur first through McKinsey. You've described yourself as an entrepreneur by nature. Can you describe what that means? How so?
Well, I don't think the word existed when I was one, actually. I think, retrospectively, I realized that's what I was. So I'd had a first career in public service, and I did not see myself as an entrepreneur, as a risk taker. It was a big deal for me to move out of the public sector to take a job in the private sector. What happened was that it became clear after a time that the thing I most liked doing was seeing a need, seeing a new idea that, would meet that need, and then building the service that would meet that need. And it happened three times while I was at McKinsey. And I ended up with this sort of quite idiosyncratic, quite unusual path through the firm as a result. It was wonderful. And, each time I think it took me a little bit closer to a sense of myself, a sense of identity that was perhaps readier to take a leap and set up my own business. Because each time I thought, actually, this does seem to be becoming a pattern. I do seem to quite like starting something new and then building a business and a coalition of support around it. So that became really sort of quite a strong part of my identity over the years.
Sure, sure. And tell us a little bit about those business lines that you helped create at McKinsey.
Oh, well, that's a nice question. So the first thing that happened was I decided that I really did want to specialize on organizational change and what it took to make people really effective, whether they're individuals or teams or whole cultures and organizations. But the thing that I was really, really interested in within that was the role of the leader. And when I say leader, I don't just mean the people right at the top of the organization. I mean anyone who's sort of trying to make things happen through other people at different levels. And I, with three other people in 2004, noticed that McKinsey, the consulting firm where I was working, did not actually have a service line around leadership. Leadership in the sense of, coaching senior clients in terms of helping them develop the bench strength, the leaders that were going to be able to, deliver whatever strategic change they were trying to make happen. And, a service line that might help a senior team be more than the sum of their parts and so on. And so the four of us banded together and, we tried to get a service line off the ground and, we succeeded. I mean, I think that, really, you don't ever do these things on your own. And the four of us didn't do it on our own. You have to build a movement. And so, you know, that's grown and grown over the years. But the roots of it were back in 2004. And everything else I did was really sort of slotted under that. So there was a big push that I made around building a business around top team effectiveness. There was one that I created around doing organizational change work in the healthcare sector. And there was one that I created where I was really partnering with someone else who'd had the ideas but hadn't yet scaled or integrated it into the rest of the firm, which was something we called centered leadership, which was about personal leadership effectiveness. So, you know, they were all quite different, but they all had this idea of, you know, helping human beings be their best, running through it.
Sure. So often the folks that are sort of on the ground do see what could be helpful and really productive for an organization, but it's often really, really difficult for those people to sort of get that done, move that project forward. How did you get buy-in as an entrepreneur? What were your personal strategies that you used to get these things moving forward?
It's a good question because you're absolutely right. When you're within an organization that has its set ways of doing things, it's not always easy to turn that super tanker around. Absolutely. And, you know, you do have to be at least as smart as an entrepreneur in thinking about how do I get people excited about doing things differently. I use different strategies each time, actually. The first time, I would say I kind of took the approach of, you know, build it and they will come. I created what I thought were amazing materials to help people do work with senior teams, huge decks of descriptions of how to run workshops and do exercises that would, you know, perhaps improve the alignment of a team around a strategic vision or whatever. And, you know, it was slow, but eventually it did work. And, you know, there were a few other things I did, but really it was sort of that central strategy. The second time was quite different. It was very much more about saying, okay, this is total green field space. This was the healthcare, doing organizational change work and in healthcare. And there I took an approach of getting a project actually up and running as quickly as possible. Really interesting project, I would say that, wouldn't I? But it was interesting. And then creating a coalition around that. And, you know, that was, you know, emailing hundreds of people and saying, who's with me? And actually then engaging those people in and coaching those people and helping them really build for themselves in their own locations that this new idea. And then the third time, as I said earlier, it was a little bit more like working with someone who had a great idea and then helping them embed and scale. And for that, you know, in a way I had to use all of the relationships I've built up over the years and pull all of those threads together. And you know, that was a different feel again. And I suppose the conclusion there is that actually it's very unlikely that what worked for you before is going to be exactly what works for you now. But I think that you want to use all of the resources you have, all of your strengths and talents, and think about everybody that you've ever known, you know, and use them in whichever way feels right, given the situation that's on your plate.
Yeah. And I think that's a really interesting point, because so often when people feel frustrated or they feel like they can't move forward, it's because they feel like they personally need to have all the answers. And they aren't maybe thinking that they can reach out to others. And in fact, they, you know, it's completely necessary because they actually, it's not completely impractical for most things to be done by one human person. And so you write a little bit about the sort of the science of getting people on board. You know, what sort of surprised you about that science and about what's sort of at work there?
Well, I think that, you know, at the heart of it, we tend to think that the brilliance of our ideas is what matters. And the truth is that that is part of the story. I mean, if you have a dumb idea, then it's going to be really hard to get people on board. But that's just the entry level. I think really it's such a personal game. And, you know, when I think about what I learned over the years, it was really that the more I could play to my own strengths in thinking about how to influence and create, I've mentioned the word coalitions before, how to create a group of people who are excited and on board. The more that I had the energy to persevere when perhaps things didn't go quite as I hoped, you know, that first experience that I had of just creating the amazing materials, you know, a lot of that was sitting on my own, sitting in front of a computer late at night, hammering away. I'm actually quite a social person. I'm a very social person. I don't know why I say actually. You know, I'm a very social person. And actually, I get such energy from feeling like I'm equipping people to achieve things that they want to achieve. So taking a more kind of coaching approach and kind of saying, okay, let me find the people who might be excited. This might be an opportunity for them. And let me help them build this. You know, that was much more going with the grain of my personality. And as a result, it felt much less tiring. And it felt enjoyable from start to finish, even when it kind of wasn't, if you see what I mean. So I do think that was, you know, that was something that I learned over the years. And I think, you know, that means that what works for you is not necessarily what's going to work for someone else. You know, sometimes you read articles and you read about, you know, what someone has done to achieve greatness in some field. And, you know, you've got to think about what really resonates with you, what's actually going to work with you. I think I'm all for, you know, stretching and learning and pushing yourself in new ways, but it's, you know, we're at our most powerful when we're doing that from a base of, you know, the stuff that we're actually good at and that really excites us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I think that's really interesting. And I think one of the things that came through in your book are these moments where you sit with yourself before you take an action and you get thoughtful about it. You know, what do I want? What are my intentions? What's my aim? What are my, you know, can you talk a little bit about why it's important to sort of like lean back and make a plan before you act?
Well, that's really, in a way, the sort of meta thesis of the book, which is to say that if we're just a little bit more deliberate about how we go into our days, actually much more becomes possible. You know, most of us, especially if we're busy, you know, we roll from one day to the next and there might be great stuff happening, but actually we're letting the day happen to us a little bit. The point about sort of stepping back is that if we can understand a little bit about the constraints that our brain faces as it navigates the day, then we can help it be at its best more often. So one example is the fact that, you know, we only ever perceive a part of reality at any given time, you know, just a fraction. And, you know, in a way, we don't know that because we don't perceive the stuff that we don't perceive. You know, we don't, they're unknown unknowns. And so the challenge for us is sort of, first of all, accepting that we only ever see a part of reality. But the opportunity is to say, actually, the things that your brain makes sure that you notice consciously tend to be things that match what's already top of mind for you. So you know that if you've ever bought a new car and then you suddenly see all the cars on the road that are the same model. If you spill coffee on yourself in the morning, then you're going to be in a bad mood and suddenly everybody seems to be a jerk. Well, that's not actually, you know, that's not random. That's actually your brain saying, oh, okay, this is what you've got top of mind. So as I'm deciding which bits of the world around you are relevant enough for you to notice, I'm going to make sure that you see things that seem to match what's top of mind for you. It's kind of sensible. But it does mean that as you go into the day, you end up with this sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. So, you know, if you are in a foul mood, actually forcing yourself to think, okay, what am I looking forward to today? Or what are three good things that I'm going to notice in this terrible commute on route to work? Just taking that moment to put better things top of mind is probably the deepest brain hack I know, because it works this selective attention mechanism and makes sure that whatever you see next is going to be of a more positive nature. And it's, I'm not saying you just, you know, you stand in the mirror and intone everything is awesome. I'm not that kind of person. I'm not saying that suddenly makes everything awesome, but I am saying that actually we have a lot more control than we think over the way that we experience each day. And that is one small example. The book has, you know, I guess 100 more of those.
Mm-hmm. No, of course. But it is a sort of a very powerful but very simple thing that you have in your book. There's a phrase in that says, you know, snark in, snark out. So can you tell us a little bit about that and what that means and why it's helpful to think about?
Yeah, well, that's really relates back to what I was just describing. If what's top of mind for you as you go into a meeting with someone is that this person has been a jerk to you in the past and you're kind of not looking forward to the meeting, or you're nervous about it, or, you know, whatever negativity there is that's there. You know, the thing is that because of confirmation bias, which is the name that behavioral scientists give to this particular phenomenon, what's going to happen is that you are then going to see everything that confirms that this person is in fact a jerk. So, you know, if you think that this conversation you're going to have is just top of mind for you, that, you know, this person's going to be a jerk, or you're kind of nervous about it, or you, then you're going to see everything that confirms that you're right to be nervous or right to be annoyed. And, you know, that's a shame, because then you do get into a conversation which is not as great, and it's harder to turn the circle the other way around. So what I'm saying is, as you're going into a meeting, yeah, okay, perhaps the person is a jerk, actually, but you could probably decide to look for something more constructive in the meeting. You could say, okay, I am going to look for ways to improve our relationship, or I'm going to look out for ways that signal that there might be some possibility of collaboration. And, you know, you can't magic up something that isn't there, but you can make sure you don't have your brain filter out what good is there that you might otherwise miss.
Sure, sure. And if you're thinking about those positive things, it'll be a little bit easier to insert those into your conversation when you're trying to be constructive with someone that maybe you need to have a hard conversation with, or maybe you just need to get on the same playing field with. You just need to understand how to move forward on something. And so if you can say, hey, I think that's really interesting, this is really great, here's the thing I have a question with. You set yourself up to have a positive question as opposed to, why are we doing this? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And you were asking a lot about influence just a second ago. And I think, you know, I said that the having a focus on the people side of things as opposed to the brilliance of your idea, you know, is central to everything that I've seen work for myself. And I do feel that sort of thinking about, where is this person coming from? What's on their mind? You know, what's really going on in their shoes, and what's going to make this idea of real benefit to them? You know, that is, you know, that's not just a nice thing to do. That is a way to have a good conversation about an idea that you want to talk about. I mean, there's lots of evidence to suggest that the more you can ask someone's advice, the more you can get them actually involved, the more you can kind of figure out how to tell a story about why this is such a great thing for them, then the more likely you are to actually have them get excited about your brilliant idea. And that's definitely what happened for me time and time again.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. We talked a little bit sort of about reactions, but let's talk about how some people don't maybe even realize it, but they become reactive as they go through the day, as opposed to maybe intentional. We don't necessarily know even that maybe we're freaking out or that we are overreacting, but what is happening to the brain in those moments, and what can we do to sort of better control them?
Well, this is the second big idea that I mentioned at the beginning, that we are constantly scanning the environment for possible threats to defend ourselves against and rewards to seek out and discover it. So I describe it as defensive mode when we're more focused on the threats in a situation, and discovery mode when we're more focused on the rewards in a situation. And the thing is that it takes very, very little to be treated by our brains as a threat. I mean, it doesn't just have to be the, you know, proverbial saber-toothed tiger bounding towards you as it might once have been. It's the same mechanism that launches this defensive fight, flight, or freeze response can be triggered by anything which undermines our sense of self-worth, our sense of social standing. So anything that makes us feel incompetent, bored, anything that makes us feel disrespected, you know, excluded. And so, you know, if you think about the workplace, you know, you're left off an email chain, and that can trigger a sense of threat. You know, you're talked over in a meeting, that can trigger a sense of threat. So it takes very little. And when we are on the defensive, what's happening is that you know, our brain only has a certain amount of mental energy. And when we are powering this fight, flight, or freeze response, which in the workplace usually looks like, you know, it's not usually people punching each other. It's actually more likely to be, you know, snappish comment or kind of avoidant behavior, that sort of thing. Any bad behavior you see in the workplace is probably someone's brain being on the defensive. And what's happening is that at that point, there's less activity in the more sophisticated part of their brain that is responsible for the higher stuff, like reasoning and self-control and forward thinking. There's less activity in their prefrontal cortex, for those who know a bit about the geography of the brain. And, you know, that's a big deal, because what it means is that, you know, when we are responding to something as if it's a threat to our self-worth or our social standing, we are dumber. I mean, you know, we are not at our best. And that's why we might say something we regret, it's not, again, it's not our imagination. Our brain is actually diverting energy away from the part of the brain that would have come up with a really nuanced, yeah, I see where you're coming from. Yeah, I totally, you know, like I'm not in the same place as you, but I understand where you're coming from, to that's wrong. To the more knee-jerk, the more basic part of the brain. And, you know, that's what's going on for us every day, actually at every moment. So the question is, how, when we're faced with something which is not delightful, how can we reduce the sense of threat and how can we amplify the sense of reward? And that is the trick. That is the central skill, I think, that helps us have a good day.
Sure, sure. And what are some strategies? Like one of the things you mentioned is distancing. You know, how can this be helpful for us in those moments?
Well, distancing is one of my favorite techniques that the research is really solid on in showing that it reduces our sense of threat. So if you ask yourself a question that puts yourself at some distance from the situation that's unfolding around you, then it helps you, helps to trick your brain in a way in saying, no, actually, this isn't happening here. It's happening somewhere else. So what I mean by that is, you know, it always really helps me to say, when I look back on this in a year's time, what will I think about this? You know, last week I was giving a talk and my microphone failed. And I mean, it was a large audience. It was a really big audience. Michelle Obama had been speaking to this, to actually a larger group than me, obviously, but it was not a small audience. And my microphone failed and nobody told me for quite a long time into the speech. Oh, ho, ho. So, you know, in that moment, one of the most powerful things, I mean, I actually had to throw about 5 or 6 different techniques at that particular moment. You can imagine.
You're throwing the whole book at that one. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that was the, but you know, this sort of stuff is happening every day to us in some small way. So, you know, the first thing I reach for is, what am I going to think of this when I look back on this? And, you know, immediately I think, oh, well, I can tell a funny story about this. Yay. But you know, it helps to think about what is your go-to distancing question. Some people like saying, what would I advise someone else if they were in my shoes? Or what would my wisest friend say to me right now? Anything which takes you out of the situation that you're in right now. And, you know, that has been shown to reduce that threat defense, activation in your brain that helps you then think more clearly about what happens next. It doesn't solve the problem, but it makes it much more likely that you're going to be able to think clearly about what to do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There was an interesting point in your book about how it's a little bit easier to give other people advice than to give yourself advice. And I think that's sort of interesting in how that sort of helps in the distancing. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think that's really something that's so practical.
Well, I think that's a great point, that actually we all kind of know that when we give someone else advice, you know, we're so wise.
Oh, I know I am.
Perspective. Yes. Right. And, you know, everybody is like that. And the reason is that we are not threatened when we feel about when we're talking about someone else's problems. So, you know, there's no issue with that cognitive impairment that happens when we feel threatened, when we feel on the defensive. Because we're dealing with someone else's problem, not ours. So, you know, that's a good signal to you that actually you have more intellectual and creative capability to find a way through a problem when you manage to get yourself a bit of distance from the situation. You know, what would I advise a friend about this? So that's why for some people that's their favorite go-to distancing question.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. A lot of the things that we've talked about here are in your resilience section of your book. And I think a lot of people, when they think about resilience, they think about some massive trauma or tragedy that happens once in a while. They're not thinking about something that they need to practice all the time. You know, why is it important to sort of remember that resilience is something that we practice?
Well, the thing is that there are bad things that happen to us a few times in our lives, but these tiny cuts that happen to us every day are enough to put us on the defensive. And so we really need some daily strategies. We need some strategies that we can reach for in seconds or even less than seconds. You know, as I'm standing on stage and my microphone not working, or you're sitting there. I mean, yesterday morning I got an email that I thought was the rudest email in the world. And I had to, you know, recognize that the chances are that I was overreacting, and that, you know, if you feel very, very negative about it, to take a moment, to take a step back and say, okay, what could I be missing here? I reread it. And of course, it wasn't half as bad. It wasn't even a quarter as bad as I thought it was the first time around. And so I luckily got to delete the flaming response that I was about to send. So, you know, these sorts of daily resilience challenges, you know, we really benefit from having a few techniques in our pocket, which get easier and easier over time. I will say that, you know, in my 20s, I was not fantastic at this personal resilience stuff. I took things personally, and, you know, a lot of us do when we're younger, but I think that, you know, that's been the biggest personal journey for me, is actually going from a place where, you know, I felt that my emotions were up and down quite a bit, to actually understanding how to keep myself more on an even keel, and, you know, actually knowing how to turn my mood around when I needed to, and knowing how to say to myself when something bad was happening that the chances are the person I was dealing with was not evil. It was actually, you know, only 1% of the population is thought to be a psychopath, which means it's, you know, it's probably the case that this person is just underslept or, you know, has stuff going on. And now that has become second nature to me. It's very, you know, it's learned, but it's easy for me to reach for. And I think my life is better as a result.
Sure, sure. What other sort of strategies do you find yourself sort of putting into practice in those moments where you're maybe about to get stuck, or you could be getting into a worried place? So what other strategies do you put into place?
Well, I mentioned that, you know, that you want to think about reducing the sense of threat, and distancing is a good technique for that. And there are others too, but that's a very good one. The other thing you can do is amplify the sense of reward in the situation, so that you get your brain out of defensive mode into discovery mode. And, you know, there are lots of things that the brain treats as a reward. Learning is one of them, actually. And, you know, we inherently seem to take pleasure in learning new things, even if it's just getting the answers in a game show. There's just this sort of ping of enjoyment. And that can be a very helpful strategy when you are in the middle of something which is not going well, is very obviously not going well, is to say, okay, how fascinating. What can I learn from this? How fascinating is a phrase that Ben Zander, the conductor, uses with his musicians when they make a mistake. You say, oh gosh, how fascinating. You can do it through gritted teeth and it still works. And then it gives you a sense of, okay, I'm getting something out of this. Another thing that the brain treats as very rewarding is your own sense of personal competence and control. And so there are other questions that I find really helpful in the moment to say, when have I solved a problem like this in the past? And what does that tell me I can do now? That's very helpful. Another question that I like is, okay, so this is all not going great. What is the ideal situation here? And what would be the very first small step towards that? And again, that gives me a sense that, okay, yeah, a lot of this is out of control, but there's a bit of it that is actually within my reach. And, you know, there's a tiny small step. And, you know, when my microphone failed, I used just about every one of those tactics and every one of those questions to figure out that, you know, what the right solution was, which ended up being unclipping my lapel mic and using it as a handheld mic, having tried 3 or 4 different things in the interim, but that was the thing that worked, allowed me to carry on. And, you know, I think everybody laughed, and that also made probably what I said after that more memorable.
Exactly. Is it surprising, do you think, to other people to realize that they can change their mind about a situation that they're currently in, and they, you know, are reacting to, you know, maybe very passionately, that maybe they can think differently about it?
Oh yeah, I think that is the main message that people can take from the behavioral science. You know, yes, life is not amazing all the time, but we have a lot more control than we tend to think we do. And, you know, some of that control comes from the tiniest shifts that can take just a fraction of a second. You know, I sometimes tell a story about a particular meeting that was going very, very badly wrong. There was someone who stormed in. She was in a foul mood and she was really radiating this to everybody. And then everybody else suddenly became in a bad mood because emotions are highly contagious between human beings. And I had a split second to think, okay, what do I do? Because this is going really badly wrong. And it really helped me to know that actually, well, if she's contagious, so am I. So I can think about what to project into the room. It really helped me to know that if I visualized something, then it would generate, research is variable on this, but you know, between 60 and 90% of the same neural activity, if I really, really, really imagined it very, very, very vividly in my mind. So to then think about, okay, well, what do I most love about working with these, this group? And to really sit there for just half a second and have all of that in mind. I can exert a positive influence on the situation, and it did calm the situation down, and you know, the storm passed. You know, this is the sort of thing that happens to us many times a day, and to know that actually you have that little bit of influence over what's going on, I think gives us back a sense that we're authors of our own lives sometimes, and that's very helpful.
Yeah. So much in our lives, the access that we have to great leaders or sort of great innovators is sort of myth or legend, right? We learn about these people that are maybe not even very nice people. Maybe they're mean, maybe they're aggressive or whatever, but most people don't get hands-on training for leadership. It's sort of learned on the job, and you kind of try what works and you sort of hope it takes, right? And so maybe the examples that you're getting are from movies or from news stories, and they may highlight the most dramatic things. And as a result, they might sort of highlight negative qualities like being really, really aggressive or, you know, being a sort of a saboteur and things like that. How can we, in your opinion, does risk-taking, which I think is really, really important for both leadership but also entrepreneurship, can it get associated with maybe the wrong qualities, which makes people sort of less apt to sort of take a moment and build the coalitions, build the communities that they need to do to move things forward?
It's interesting. I think you're absolutely right. In our popular culture, we think of risk-taking as, you know, high drama, dare I say, testosterone, you know, fueled decisions, because actually it turns out that testosterone is positively correlated with risk-taking in both men and women. But I think actually, when I think about myself and the realization that I'm actually a risk-taker, you know, I'm a very measured person. I'm a very reflective person. So, you know, there's clearly a different way to be a risk taker. You know, when I was quitting my amazing job as a partner at McKinsey to, you know, strike out on my own and, you know, write this book, and, you know, a lot of people were saying, are you crazy? But, you know, I did some careful thinking. I thought very carefully about not just the big opportunity, but also I did what's known as mental contrasting, where I thought about everything that could go wrong and everything that might derail me, including, you know, financial challenges. You know, what if I didn't have any clients for a year? And then really bottom those things out and scenario plan those things out. And so, you know, I got to the point where it felt like it was just the right thing to do. It felt like less of a risk, and I had a clear sense of the paths forward if, you know, various things happened that were not, you know, were not perfect. And I think, you know, when I look back, you know, that's taking a risk, but it's taking a risk with your eyes open. And so, you know, you've got a sense of, you know, what all the different paths look like. And I think the other thing that has been really consistent for me when I think about the risks that I've taken is this focus on learning that I mentioned before. You know, it's inherently rewarding to think about what you're learning. When you take a risk, there are so many things that are, you know, not enjoyable when you do have the ups and downs, and to focus on what are you learning in this situation. And yes, this might not work, but what am I going to learn from this that I can take into the next venture, the next idea? And I think that those two things have been central to me enjoying becoming a risk taker. And I definitely feel that, you know, if we all thought about our new career adventures in those ways, you know, we might see more people daring to take that step. We might also enjoy ourselves more, whether it goes right or wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Take a moment, listen to the situation, and then listen to yourself. Yeah. That's all the time we have, but thank you very much, Caroline, for all of your insights. And to listen to more podcasts from this series, find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and follow us on SoundCloud.